I'm Matthew Petty and this is Intersection. What do social media companies do with all that data they've got from you? How sophisticated does a phishing email have to be to work? And what's the downside to the Internet of Things like smartwatches, smart fridges and smart toys? These are just some of the questions that keep Dr. Jan Solihin up at night. He's the director of the UCF Cybersecurity and Privacy Cluster, a department in the College of Engineering and Computer Science that's growing to meet the need for better cybersecurity. I sat down with Solihin to talk about some of the challenges his group is wrestling with and what the future of cybersecurity could look like. Solihin's research is focused on the interface between hardware and software. He began by talking about the advances in hardware and software design.
In fact, for the last few decades, hardware progressed a lot faster than software. So we essentially were able to double the number of transistors. Essentially, transistor is an electrical switch. Mm-hmm. We doubled the number of transistors every 18 months until just a few years ago when it started to slow down a little bit.
There's actually a formula for that, right?
Yeah, it's called Moore's Law. It's not an actual law, but it's a prediction. And for some reason, the semiconductor industry has been really good at, essentially tracking that prediction for decades. So mm-hmm. that was very impressive.
But your focus is on cybersecurity and the kind of interface between the hardware and the software.
Right.
And as far as cybersecurity goes, it seems to me that it's been in the news more lately. I mean, there's been news about phishing attacks, from presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's email hacks to hacks on healthcare groups like Family Physicians Group here in Orlando. Back us up a little bit and tell us what a phishing attack is and how that sort of plays into what you do in your research.
Yeah, so phishing attack essentially typically starts with an email. Someone essentially pretending to be someone else that the receiver may be fooled into thinking that. So let's say I may receive an email from someone pretending to be my bank, let's say BB&T, and mm-hmm. ask me for account verification. And then if I click on the link, I enter my information, my password, and so on. It turns out it's not BB&T, but it's someone else pretending to be BB&T, and they get a hold of my information. So it's very prevalent now.
Is this kind of like a low-tech hack, like a simple thing, do you think? Because it's more about somebody getting fooled by what they think is something real when it's not. Like, how high-tech is that?
It has been low-tech, but it exploits like a psychological weakness of people. And, you know, sometimes we are just busy. Mm-hmm. We don't pay attention too much to a single email. And, yeah, it's low-tech, but it's increasingly becoming high-tech. There is something called spear phishing, in which the attacker utilizes essentially very personal information. Mm-hmm. And let's say they mine it through, let's say, social media or through other means. They can pretend to be your uncle, mm-hmm. and they can sound like your uncle and so on. Yeah. Hmm.
So they're using, like, voice-changing technology and that kind of thing to try and make you think that you're speaking to somebody that you know.
Yeah, that's within their capability these days, yeah. Mm-hmm. So they could. But they could, use a simpler technology, say, you know, they know your, let's say your uncle is finished traveling somewhere, and they mine it from the, let's say, Facebook account. Mm-hmm. And then they can, you know, they can include that trip, and then it makes you, it fools you into thinking that's the real uncle. Yeah.
And is that something where we can expect to see more of those kind of high tech, you know, uses of technology to try and trick people into thinking something is something that it's not? Or what about, for example, deep fakes and things like that, where they're able to kind of construct a pretty convincing video of somebody or an audio recording of somebody that actually isn't them, but it sounds pretty close to the real thing?
Yeah, in fact, that is extremely concerning. And I think, the technology is only getting better, where they can generate, you know, fake video of somebody else. And that's actually very high-tech, because they use a 3D model synthesized from many photos, and then They also synthesize a voice based on recording, and they use artificial intelligence to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very concerning, and it's going to be applied not for phishing, but also for misinformation, and for interfering with the election or public opinion to sway it in one way or another. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How much of what your department does focuses on some of those kind of bigger, more philosophical kind of questions of swaying an election? That's a pretty big deal, right? Do you sort of look into some of the how and the wherefore of those things and try to figure out ways to get around that?
Yeah, so we focus mostly on the nuts and bolts of how these attacks happen. So for example, there is a machine learning group here that looks into deepfakes. From our point of view, so we want to, some of our research wants to add trustworthiness to information source.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if we see a video or image, can we at least certify, essentially certify the audit information about that image? Let's say
mm-hmm.
this image was taken on the following date, using the following camera, mm-hmm. At the following altitude, and stuff like that.
So you'd put like a watermark on it to say this is kosher, this is genuine.
Yeah. So we add metadata to mm-hmm. to this data such that the metadata can say something about the data in a cryptographic way. So it cannot be tampered by attackers without being detected.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm talking to Dr. Jan Solehin. He is the Director of Cybersecurity and Privacy Cluster at UCF. What about things like ransomware attacks? Are you seeing more of those as well?
Yeah, ransomware, I think the technology behind it has been around mm-hmm. because essentially it's just encrypting your files. But recently, because there is cryptocurrency, there is a mechanism for attacker to demand a ransom without revealing their identity.
Mm-hmm.
So then it took off like a few years ago, became a lot more prevalent mm-hmm. now because of that payment mechanism. Yeah, it's certainly a problem, especially for organizations that have low IT budget.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, there was a ransomware attack not long ago with the city of Baltimore. And, they were struggling with their budget, and they, they spent only half of the IT budget compared to other cities.
Mm-hmm.
And that means they're going to overlook some obvious things that, IT department has to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's dangerous, essentially, with ransomware.
That'll be a lot of pressure on a city's IT department thinking that they could get hit with one of these attacks, right? Because that would be pretty devastating for a city. I mean, I can't imagine, what that would do to, say, the city of Orlando if this city got hit with a ransomware attack.
Yeah, so the attacker, essentially, with ransomware, they get a hold of your system, let's say initially through phishing.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they get a hold of your system, it generates a random key and then uses that random key to encrypt your files. So your files don't disappear. They're not deleted. They are there. But they have been encrypted such that you cannot see the content anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think it's very troubling. Essentially makes people panic, right? So... And then the next step for the attacker is to demand for ransom, and they essentially say, "Give us some payment, and then we will decrypt your file so that you can access it again."
Mm-hmm.
And that payment is typically through cryptocurrency because it's convenient and preserves anonymity.
It's not just a concern for like a city or a health organization, right? There is also people's personal information that can get ensnared in some of these ransomware attacks, right? Yeah. I mean, that's got to be a worry for individuals. Like, what if my social security number gets lost in an attack, or you know, what if people get a hold of other sensitive information that I don't want getting out there? So what's the kind of key to making people feel more secure about all that information of theirs that's out there and that is vulnerable to hacking and attacks?
Unfortunately, I don't have a good answer to that. It's pretty troubling. But you know, I think there are kind of like good practices that mm-hmm. can reduce the risk of getting this kind of security attacks, right? So, you know, there is something called cyber hygiene, which is essentially ensuring that employees don't fall into phishing attack easily. Mm-hmm. So they constant training is needed. And at UCF, for example, we have the IT team kind of like design their own phishing email for simulating an attack.
And they try it out in real time?
Yeah, they try it in real time, and then they figure out, you know, which people kind of fall into that mm-hmm. and what is the rate of the success and so on. So, and then they can, you know, target some people for retraining or that kind of thing. So that I think is very useful.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the bigger kind of global security implications of cybersecurity and some of the research that your cluster does? Like, what direction are we heading in there, and how big a part of, interactions between different countries is cybersecurity going to be in the future, do you think?
Well, I think, unfortunately, cybersecurity is, I think, being weaponized.
Mm-hmm.
It will become, involved more and more in cyber warfare. And it has some kind of desirable features. Nobody dies from it, right? Or maybe this. But it can essentially give a warning. Mm-hmm. To the adversary, hey, we have this capability, and we can really disrupt and make your life really difficult.
And there are real consequences to some of those intrusions, right? I mean, say if a malign agent got into somebody's energy system and were able to shut down nuclear reactors or something, that would be pretty disastrous, right?
You're absolutely right. So increasingly. So in the past, computer systems are just computer systems, right? Mm-hmm. They don't interact too much with the physical world. But increasingly, it's become the case that they are intertwined with the physical world. Yeah. So I think the U.S. government, for example, has been concerned with the electrical grid security.
Mm-hmm.
There is a talk, for example, for an inverter use in a solar farm.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that there is a concern about the supply chain of that inverter supply, you know, manufactured by potentially untrusted facility.
Mm-hmm.
And if enough of these are involved and they can essentially send wrong information to the grid, and then the grid can essentially has a cascading failure.
Mm-hmm.
And that affects a lot of people. But at the smaller scale, even let's say pacemaker,
mm-hmm.
This is being being made smarter by connecting it to the internet, right, with TCP/IP,
mm-hmm.
and that brings a new kind of like vulnerability in which, you know, someone can mess up with the pacemaker and then cause a harm to individuals. I mean, there are a lot of vulnerabilities. So, for example, operating system, typically the operating system developer release patches.
Mm-hmm.
A good practice is to immediately apply the new patch, right?
Mm-hmm. But because we're human, we don't always do that.
Right, exactly. So there are a lot of places in which the patch has been released for more than a year and the operating system still has not been updated. So that's extremely vulnerable. And attackers know that, but they don't always exploit that because, you know, maybe there are some lower hanging fruit somewhere else.
What keeps you up at night?
I think the scariest thing to me is the Internet of Things. Mm-hmm. So with the cloud, you know, I think there are some, you know, if we put our data in the cloud, it's relatively okay, relatively safe. There are some attacks that can be done in the cloud, but in at the Internet of Things level. Essentially, we are augmented our life. You know, we have smart light bulbs, smart toaster, smart mm-hmm. Refrigerator, and smart watch, and so on. This is all being developed in a rush. There is no incentive for manufacturers to follow the best practices in security, or because they wanted to go out to the market as soon as possible,
mm-hmm.
and the product is expected to be cheap. And because of that, then there are not many eyeballs. So they don't have a large development team. There are not many eyeballs looking at, the code, making sure there are no vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is just accident waiting to happen. So there are a lot of examples of that. So there was a Fisher-Price, a teddy bear toy
mm-hmm.
with a camera on the nose. There was a release a few years ago, and it turns out that it's vulnerable to hacking. So attacker can, in theory, they can essentially bypass the, get a hold of this system and then activate the video camera and then record everything that that happens in the house or in the child, right, interaction with the child.
Yeah, which is pretty troubling for a parent.
Right, right. But there was also more intentional or semi-malicious one, which is, let's say, baby doll
mm-hmm.
called My Friend Kayla. That was released recently. And so it turns out that this company produced this My Friend Kayla. It can talk with the child. It can record the child and then send the conversation to the cloud for processing, and then it will give an intelligent response and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the cloud, it turns out they are running a transcription software and transcribes that conversation between the doll and the child.
Mm-hmm.
And they are selling that that transcription with a third-party company. So there's a value to data. So data is valuable. They're selling it. Mm-hmm. And because the law has not caught up with that, so they were able to do that.
So your advice might be maybe think twice before buying that cool new toy which has some kind of fancy internet-connected capability.
Yeah, exactly. So that's my concern. A lot of people, they try to be, when it comes to their, computers, right, physical computers, Wi-Fi router, they know how to, they know that they should use encryption, they use, firewall and stuff like that. But when it comes to toys, they overlook all these vulnerabilities.
Well, Dr. Jan Salihin is the Director of Cybersecurity and Privacy Cluster at University of Central Florida. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Matthew.
Up next, we talk to the creators of Orange County's Fusion Fest about celebrating the region's diversity of cultures. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando is the crossroads of the world, welcoming millions of visitors a year, along with communities from 140 different cultures who live in the City Beautiful. Finding a way to celebrate the diversity of Central Florida and demonstrate how different cultures influence each other led to Fusion Fest, a two-day festival that debuted last Thanksgiving weekend. Fusion Fest is back this year, and joining us to talk more about what's involved are Tali Sugisawa and Terry Olson.
Well, Tali Sugisawa is the business maven for Fusion Fest. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by Terry Olson. He is the chief instigator for Fusion Fest. Terry, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
So, Terry, if I could just start with you, what exactly is Fusion Fest and how did it get started?
Fusion Fest is a two-day celebration of Central Florida and all of its global roots.
Mm-hmm.
So it is about honoring all of our heritages while we're exploring and celebrating how we're now influencing each other as we're creating our own unique Central Florida identity.
Tali, Orlando is kind of a melting pot, right? I mean, there are a lot of different cultures blending and mixing here in the City Beautiful.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's no better place to hold a festival like this one where we're still very young. Of course, we have silos in the city, but we're still pretty young that we can bring everyone together to celebrate not only their heritage, but also the fusion of different cultures and how actually we become one Central Floridian.
So that's where the fusion comes in? It's like the mixing of these different cultures?
Yeah, it's like, you know, you have Japan Festival and then you have India Fest and Puerto Rican Day Parade. And the idea was really like, let's bring everyone together and we can celebrate and learn from each other.
So last year being the inaugural, did you kind of go into it thinking we're not sure exactly what this is going to be? Was it a bit of a sort of a beta test for the festival?
So, yeah, I was willing to add that because we actually started the planning of Fusion Fest back in 2016. Mm-hmm. So Fusion Fest is a grassroots movement. And right about 2016 is when Terry got together a bunch of people from first or second generation immigrants here to brainstorm, like, how can we honor our heritage but also come together as one. Mm-hmm. And a festival and a parade came up, and then we started these little explorations of gatherings of nations, that's how we call it back then. And every other month, well, a steering committee was formed, and then every other month we would gather around one aspect of culture, for example, food, music, dance, fashion, and so on. So those were stepping stones to the actual festival that happened in 2018, so 2 years later.
Mm-hmm. So Terry, tell me a little bit about the genesis for the idea. Like, what was it that made you think this is what we need to do and we need to do it now?
Well, personally, my kind of mission in life is to create dynamic events that enliven people. So I love bringing people together. This is a little different realm that I thought of, but at the time, my boss, Mayor Jacobs, was interested in supporting diversity, and so I held that first brainstorming even before Tally was involved. We had some ideas, but nothing kind of happened to that until a year later when some of the folks from the African Leaders Council and the Caribbean Cultural Council came to me and said, hey, can't we get some of this going? And that's when we started this kind of grassroots movement that eventually gained the support of Orange County and the city of Orlando.
Have you seen other festivals in other cities that kind of gave you an idea of what it should look like, or is it completely from scratch?
Well, my history is a lot about festivals. SAC Theater, that I'm a co-founder of, was formed to perform at Renaissance festivals around the country. And then after we came and we're at Epcot Center, we started doing fringe festivals, and I, one of the founders of the Orlando Fringe. So festivals are very much a part of my history. But as we've researched this kind of thing, fusion fests, there are international festivals that kind of set up, as Tally said, silos, like, okay, here's an Asian silo and my silo is better than your silo kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But we haven't really found any that have the focus that we do that's about, okay, now we're here together. How are we influencing each other? And how does that make us more creative and innovative because we've got this cross-pollination of ideas and thoughts, which studies have shown are the result of that kind of cross-pollination is always more innovation and more influence. So we think we are the crossroads of the world here at Orlando with 75 million visitors every year. And we've had people from all over settling here. And we've had people from the world all over looking at us the last few years since Pulse to see how we respond to acts of hate. So we think this is the time and the place to show the world that people with different lifestyles, different ethnicities, heritages can live together in a non-divisive way, respectful and with a basis of love as opposed to fear. We always tend to fear things that are different from us, but we're here together, so let's get over that and let's figure out how we can be the most innovative city in the world.
Tali, is it difficult to get people to break out of those silos and maybe kind of let go a little bit of their sort of pride in their own culture and think about how the different cultures influence each other?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But I feel like once we get to the point that we can explain that, you know, you're come to Fusion Fest, participate, your culture will be honored and you learn from other people, then I feel like people are more open to try it. And we've been talking to a lot of communities, to the Asian, Hispanic, and of course they feel way more comfortable being in their silo and in their zone. And as Terry was saying, the different, most of the times it's scary for them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they are ashamed of their accent. I was once like that too. I'm always conscious about if I'm pronouncing the right words. So I do relate to them, and I know that it's easier to be in that silo. But our invitation is, come out. We got you. Mm-hmm. We got this. Let's do this together.
You can be you here.
You can be you here.
So there is a call to action too, right? You're looking for people to take part in the festival in some way or other. What exactly are you asking for?
Yeah, right now we are in the Join Us campaign. So we're looking for performing artists, musicians, dancers, fashion designers. We're looking for filmmakers or people who want to share their Central Florida stories in the migration film program that it's in partnership with the Global Peace Film Festival. We're looking for food vendors, merchandise vendors, and service vendors as well. So our event takes place in front of Dr. Phillips Center and takes all the space in City Hall Commons Plaza. And we want to fill that up with music, dance, interactive art installation. We will have also a tent that it's a games and recreation tent that you'll be able to go there and learn over 20 different games. So yeah, right now we're in this phase of come join us, come volunteer, come perform, come help us, come sell your products, mm-hmm. and come sponsor us, be our partner.
What kind of response did you have to last year's festival?
It was really amazing, and I was really, really happy to see the results. And also from minute one, I was already like, oh, next year we need to do this different, mm-hmm. and next year we should keep this or change this. And Terry is very good at keeping in touch with people. So after the festival, he sent out a survey asking them what do they think and asking their feedback. And we had really wonderful feedbacks and some areas to be improved. But most people, I think they said that they felt safe. Mm-hmm. They loved exposing their kids to the cultures, to different cultures, and that they spent both days immersed in a bunch of different things, and they were like busy, like hands-on stuff. We had language lessons, 15-minute language lessons, so you could walk in there and learn how to speak a couple of sentences in Russian or Japanese. So, and for this year, we're bringing more content, so we are confident that people will enjoy even more.
Mm-hmm. And there were Central Floridians from 110 different heritages that participated as performers or vendors or volunteers at the festival last year.
That's a pretty broad range of folks. Would that kind of surprise you, the fact that there was that diversity in the community?
Well, we say that everyone has a heritage, and it's whatever they say it is. So in my database, I have a place to indicate what people say is their heritage. I have over 140 heritages listed. But in our public schools, we have over 160 languages spoken. We are a very diverse community. In fact, I've heard someone say in a meeting that projections are by the year 2030, Orlando may be the most diverse city in the world.
Hmm. Sounds like it's well on its way to becoming that even now, right?
Yep.
Is it kind of hard to wrap your arms around what Orlando is, given the fact that it is so diverse? I mean, if you have that many languages, that many cultures, does it kind of make it a bit hard to pinpoint this is Orlando?
So I've been here over 30 years, and the identity of Orlando or the greater Orlando area has always been a question because we are so new and so diverse, and I think that's fine. Like our phrase is, I can be me here, mm-hmm. whatever that is.
How do you feel about that phrase, Tali?
I love that phrase. It's part of my story. So, you know, Matt, I was born and raised in Brazil, but in a Japanese family. And that phrase really sums up my journey to Orlando as a 10-year-old. When I came here for the first time, I really felt like I could just be me here. If one day, as a 10-year-old dreaming, I moved here, maybe I could just be me. And I didn't have to fit in being Japanese or fit in being Brazilian because I could never really embrace either one of them fully. And it felt like it was wrong to be half and half. But here, no, I think here it's completely different, and I do feel like I can be myself here.
So the festival is celebrating that.
Yes.
What were some of the standouts from last year for you?
I'm going to say, so at the end of both days, we also have a what we call diversitastic. Ooh, that one is hard. Diversitastic choir, and we invite a bunch of choirs from all over Central Florida to join in school choirs, and they sang a song that was written for the festival that it's called I Can Be Me Here, and I think that was the highlight. My mom was at the festival. She was one of the vendors. She's a visual artist. And then she was telling me later, so like, I was so embarrassed. They started singing, and then I saw like kids and people from like different parts of the world, and they are all singing together the same song. And I was so emotional. I was like trying to hide my tears, and like, but then I looked to the side and everyone was crying. So just like, oh, that's really beautiful, really. So Yeah, I think at the end of the festival, like everyone coming together was really like the highlight for me as well.
So you're striving to capture some of that this year too.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have the same elements. We're just adding more elements this year.
Mm-hmm. All right. So when's the cutoff for people who want to take part?
It's August 1st, so it's coming up, and please join us. Everything is on our website. You go to fusionfest.org, and everything is there. All the sign-ups are online, and we can't wait to have you.
And you've already got a good kind of slate of performers and vendors and so forth.
Yes, we do. We're still lacking some representation. We want to make sure we have that everyone is covered, that all the regions of the world are covered. So we're still lacking some, and that's why we're pushing and asking people to please sign up to be a part of this celebration.
Well, Tali Sugisawa, business maven for Fusion Fest, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Matt.
And Terry Olson, chief instigator, thank you as well.
You bet, my pleasure.
Up next, Central Florida Star Wars fans are awaiting the opening of Galaxy's Edge at Disney World. Theme park writer Seth Kuberski joins us for a rundown of what's new at Disney and Universal. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Central Florida Star Wars fans are awaiting the opening of Galaxy's Edge at Disney World later this summer. Seth Kuberski, who paid a visit to the Star Wars-themed attraction when it opened in Disneyland, joins us for an update on the new attractions at Disney and Universal. Well, Seth Kuberski is the co-author of the unofficial guides, including the unofficial guide to Disneyland and the unofficial guide to Universal Orlando. He's also a columnist with the Orlando Weekly. Thanks for coming back, Seth.
Always great talking to you.
So, summertime, I guess, a pretty busy season for theme parks. Tell me about what's going on at Universal. There's a new ride tied into Harry Potter. They're still making kind of headway on that franchise. What's going on there?
Yeah, so Universal's new addition this season was Hagrid's Magical Creatures Motorbike Adventure. That's a mouthful. And that's a new dark ride slash roller coaster over in Islands of Adventure. It's near the Forbidden Journey ride. It's part of Hogsmeade, which was the original Wizarding World of Harry Potter, and it replaced the Dueling Dragons roller coasters, which were originally known as the formerly known as the Dragon Challenge. I know some fans were disappointed that the replacement does not have the big loops, the huge drops, but what it does have is the most high-speed launches in one roller coaster anywhere, and the longest track of any roller coaster in Florida. It's nearly a mile long, so it's a good long ride. It's accessible in the sense that you don't have restraints going over your shoulders. It doesn't flip upside down. It's not so intense that younger tweens or older grandparents can't get on it. So it kind of provides a thrill that's accessible to the whole family. And in a big change for Universal, there's no 3D screens. There's no video projections. This is all real sets, real trees, animatronic figures, the kind of rich detailed environment that you used to only get from a Disney attraction.
Hmm. And is that what audiences want?
Yeah, I think there is definitely a shift, especially among Universal guests, away from the screen-based attractions, the 3D attractions. You know, Universal established their brand on the idea of riding the movies, and a lot of that was tied to sitting in front of a screen with a seat that shakes around, something like the Back to the Future ride, which is now The Simpsons, or the Shrek 4D movie. But, you know, after building a lot of screen-based attractions back-to-back, the Transformers ride, the Gringotts ride, the King Kong ride, there's kind of been a backlash from guests who don't like having to put on a pair of 3D glasses every time they walk into an attraction. Mm-hmm. And the biggest sign of that backlash is that Universal, just this past week, removed the 3D effects from the Despicable Me Minion Mayhem attraction. Now, that ride kind of led the vanguard of Universal's current wave of 3D rides. And now that they're going back, removing those 3D effects, it'll be really interesting to see whether that increases the ride's popularity or if people feel that, well, now without the 3D, is there really a point in paying all this money to go to a theme park to sit in a chair in front of a screen when I can do that at a movie theater at home?
Mm-hmm. So why the move away from 3D? What are you hearing about that?
There's a bunch of factors. One is that there definitely is a portion of the theme park going population that either has bad physical reactions to 3D. You know, it gives some people headaches. It makes some people motion sick. It can also tend to slow down the queues and increase labor costs because, you know, you've got to hand out the glasses, you've got to collect the glasses, and most importantly, you've got to clean the glasses for the next guest. But I think on a fundamental level, what it comes down to is people want real things. When they are making the trip away from their house where they've got a big screen TV at home, they've got an Xbox at home, they maybe even have one of these new virtual reality headsets at home. So if they're going to go and spend the money to spend a day at a theme park, they want to be surrounded by real things that they can't see anywhere else.
And what about that next level then? Because a couple years ago, especially if you went to IAPA, it was all about the VR, you know, the next level of what theme parks were doing there. What's happening in that space?
Yeah, virtual reality flamed up and flamed out even quicker than 3D did. But you're not going to see that coming to Disney. Disney's publicly said that they don't think that virtual reality is the future. What might be the future is augmented reality, which is where you wear glasses, where you can see the real world around you, but you also see digital characters overlaid on the real world, integrated into the real world.
Kind of like Pokemon.
Exactly. So imagine glasses that let you see those kind of integrated digital creatures in the real world. Mm-hmm. I think a place where we might see that used is in the Super Nintendo Land that Universal is working on right now. It's going to open first in Japan and in Hollywood, but it's likely going to be part of the new resort that Universal is working on near the convention center.
That's interesting. So are they kind of going for a particular demographic there? Maybe people who grew up playing those video games as kids?
Yeah, and those people who played, you know, Donkey Kong and Mario Brothers back in the 80s, now we're grown up, we have kids, some of us have grandkids. So that is absolutely a demographic that spans over multiple generations. You know, you have adults who remember the games from when they were kids, and you have kids now who play these same games on the Nintendo Switch. Mm-hmm. Now, I know Universal does not want people wandering around their theme park staring at their Nintendo Switch all day. So there's going to have to be some new form of technology, some advancement that lets you keep your head up and look around at what's going on around you, but at the same time experience these augmented reality virtual characters. Mm-hmm. And that's something really exciting that I think we're going to see coming in the next few years.
Seth, talk to me a little bit about what's happening at Disney. You spent a bit of time at Star Wars Land at out in Disneyland in California, and this is an attraction that is opening at Disney World too. What did you see, and what can we expect here?
Yeah, I got to visit Star Wars Galaxy's Edge both during the private preview period where they were limiting how many guests could go in, and then I went back again after it opened to the general public. And Star Wars Galaxy's Edge is 14 acres. It currently contains one ride, which is a Millennium Falcon simulator ride. And at the end of this year, here in Florida, they're going to also open a second ride called Rise of the Resistance, which is an epic indoor dark ride that's supposedly one of the largest attractions Disney's ever created. The land is very well detailed. If you are a fan of immersive environments, rich texture, architecture, you're going to fall in love. It takes kind of the same blueprint that Universal did with the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, you know, taking something that fans want to see, building it in exacting detail, making it completely immersive. But it's much bigger. The Star Wars land is about the size of both Harry Potter lands plus the Avatar land put together. Mm-hmm. What I will say is, though, it's beautiful and there's lots to look at, but there isn't, especially at the moment, a lot to do. There are lots of shopping opportunities. There's food. But right now there's only one ride. And what surprised me the most about going out to visit in California, I really feared that it would be packed, that it would be just overwhelmed with people and that you would wait an hour in line just to get a drink of water. And instead, it was the complete opposite. And maybe that's the fault of journalists like me who are going around telling people how busy it was probably going to be for the whole first season. Truthfully, it was the opposite. It was one of the most peaceful, relaxed, quiet experiences I've ever had at Disneyland. And I wish I could say the same was going to happen when it opens here in late August. But unfortunately, I think it's going to be the opposite situation. I think a lot of people who held off from going to see it in California because they were afraid of crowds, then heard that it wasn't that crowded, are going to say, well, I'll go to Disney World. I think that if you are hoping to see Star Wars in Orlando this year, that you should be prepared to book yourself an on-site hotel room and get to the park at 6 a.m. because that's when they're going to be opening it for on-site guests. I think there will be people who are willing to do it. There's probably going to be people willing to camp out overnight to make sure that they're the first ones on the Millennium Falcon. But if the pattern holds anything like what we saw in California, there will be an initial rush. But then... you know, we'll see if that interest sustains.
August opening for Star Wars Land at Disney World. You got a feel for whoever is in the Wookiee suit, right?
Oh yeah, the performers who are, as Disney says, friends with the characters in fur, especially Chewbacca, are going to have their work cut out for them this summer. I do hope that that Wookiee has an air conditioner inside that fur.
Right.
I will say that my favorite part of Star Wars Land out in California was the character interactions. You've got Rey and Chewbacca wandering around. You've also got Kylo Ren and First Order stormtroopers. And they don't just stand there posing for pictures. They have the whole little storylines, and they act out little skits, and they interact with the guests. I got to be recruited by Chewbacca to help with the Resistance, and we played a little game of telephone. He taught me how to talk Wookiee. And those are the kind of, you know, magical little personal interactive moments that I think are really going to sell the land even more so than the rides or the blue milk, which is frankly undrinkable.
So that's kind of, I guess, ties back into that theory that you have that, you know, Disney is saying we don't need VR headsets and the like. We can kind of do this with some real interaction with characters and a more immersive, you know, physical environment.
And I think Bob Iger, Disney's CEO, has said that almost in those words that what makes theme parks and Disney theme parks specifically special is that it's high touch. You know, you're having a personal one-on-one interaction with a Star Wars character or a princess or a Marvel superhero, you know, depending on which park you're at.
Do you think they've kind of tapping into the experience you might get from going to a Comic-Con too?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's interesting because cosplay, you know, people dressing up as their characters has gone from a small niche thing to a huge industry with, you know, people making costumes, people becoming famous for wearing costumes. And specifically at Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, they definitely tapped into that by selling beautiful, authentic Jedi robes and tunics and masks and costumes. The ironic thing is that if you are over the age of 14, you can purchase those items, but you're not allowed to wear them inside the park.
For security reasons?
For security reasons, Disney is concerned with guests being confused as employees, which is understandable. But, you know, Universal lets their guests buy and wear their Harry Potter robes, and they definitely make a lot of money over people buying robes and wands so that they can use them around the parks. It'd be interesting to see how long Disney can enforce the idea that you can buy these clothes here in the park, but we will throw you out if you try putting them on.
Mm-hmm. I want to just come back to Universal for a moment.
Sure.
And we're only a few months out from Halloween Horror Nights, I guess.
Yes.
Although it is high summer right now. Universal Studios recently announcing the Ghostbusters maze for Halloween Horror Nights based on the 1984 movie. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so Universal, this is the second year now that Universal has gone with a 1980s retro theme. It's not explicit, but it's kind of underlies all the choices that they make this year and last year. You know, Mike Aiello, who is in charge of Halloween Horror Nights, he's like me. He's kind of a child of the 80s. And, you know, the people who are designing Halloween Horror Nights are kind of tapping into those TV shows and those movies that they loved as a kid and bringing them into the parks. The interesting thing is that there's a little bit of backlash from some of the hardcore horror fans that they're saying, well, Ghostbusters, that's not a horror movie. That's a comedy, you know. Mm-hmm. But there's also the Halloween part. You know, it's not just Horror Nights, it's Halloween Horror Nights. And there's always an aspect to Halloween that's not just gory or bloody, but it's kind of spooky and silly and a little campy, too.
Sure, yeah.
You know, last year they got great acclaim with a Poltergeist haunted house. And I think that Ghostbusters is going to kind of tap into that same nostalgia. And it should also, some of the younger guests who maybe don't know the Ghostbusters or only know it from the more recent remake, mm-hmm. this will spark some interest. I personally am really happy because my first job working at Universal back 20-something years ago was on the Ghostbusters show, which no longer exists, hasn't existed in a long time. So I'm very excited. I'm hoping that maybe some of the old props that were still in storage from that old show will get dragged out and put in the haunted house.
So it's like a double nostalgia trip for you.
Absolutely. And the other side of that is Stranger Things is coming back to Halloween Horror Nights. And Stranger Things is all about 1980s nostalgia. Mm-hmm. It was a huge hit for Universal last year. Brought in a lot of guests who otherwise wouldn't be going to a haunted house event because they were fans of Stranger Things. In a similar way, a few years back, Walking Dead brought in a lot of guests who weren't necessarily Halloween Horror Nights fans. They were Walking Dead fans.
Mm-hmm.
So Stranger Things is coming back again. It's going to highlight the second and third season of the show, the third season that just came out. So I personally am excited to walk through a recreation of the Star Court Mall.
Well, Seth Kaberski is the co-author of the unofficial guides, including the unofficial guide to Disneyland and the unofficial guide to Universal Orlando. He's also a columnist for the Orlando Weekly. Seth, thank you so much.
Thank you. I will see you around the parks.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Paola Chinchilla. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.